Child expert and licensed therapist Allison David Maxson had a unique way of putting into words what the rare outings were like for the children. We live in a world of light on the Earth's surface where there is sun shining, birds singing, people talking, the world carrying on around us. That level of stimulus is something that we, who grew up with all these noises, smells, and sights going on around us, our brains were able to distinguish what we were trying to concentrate on or where our attention lies. The rest, we tune out because it doesn't pertain to that exact moment. Think of these blimps of conversations we hear passing groups of people in the mall, shopping through the grocery store, and by simply walking down the street. 9 times out of 10, you catch a word, maybe a sentence. But because your brain isn't focused on that, it lives only in the short memory. And when another memory is made, it replaces it. The Turpin children lived a mile below us. Their world was dark, quiet. Mealtimes were scheduled. Eating whenever you felt like was something that they had been trained to consider. In this dark, bleak world, the only thing to know is suffering, pain, darkness, a life of hell. So when Louise and David would bring them to the surface to force a picture that they are one big happy family, it did more harm than good. The children were seeing, smelling, hearing, and feeling a world that was so foreign to them. Their cognitive abilities were seriously lacking, and processing only what you are concentrating on is no longer possible. Their brains are not used to the millions of different stimuli. It doesn't know how to block out those things that are not needed. Everything they were hearing, seeing, smelling, experiencing, were all stimulating their flight or fight response. Filters were never taught to them. And it made the promise of escaping even more terrifying beyond the potential punishment if they got caught. Now, they have a fear of not being able to function in a world where everything is said and done based strictly on what their body is telling them. Life for the Turpin children, we're far from what life looks like to you and me. We walk the beaches, share the land with other groups of people, there to simply have fun. But for the Turpin children, all they can focus on is everything surrounding them. That life is no life to lead. Either freedom promised that was the life they would be thrown into, and if you see, feel, and hear that you are not capable of being a functional person, you start to feel relief when returned to the dark world they lived a mile below everyone else. Stockholm Syndrome is defined in Webster's Dictionary as the psychological tendencies of a hostage to bond with, identify with, or sympathize with his or her captor. All 12 of the Turpin children suffered from Stockholm by any and every definition of the word. The way that they probably suffered from being overstimulated during a family outing pushed them back to the house that had become their prison. It pushed them back to their rooms and welcomed the biting of the chains, all because their brain was never taught how to function in a world that continued on around them, unaware of someone's psychological or physical storm raging on inside of them. Welcome to the True Crime Librarian. I'm your librarian and host, Ashley. Let's close out this case of torture, abuse, and neglect all dealt by the two people whose only desire should have been to protect their own. Instead, they became two people who would put them through unimaginable torture. David and Louise would bring one more child into this world, but one of her older sisters saved her from ever feeling what Louise and David are capable of. Baby Jana would only ever know the nicer side of mother and father. She may have escaped their evilness, but Louise and David's dark mark on her history is one she'll never be able to escape. Let's close out this case in season 4 of TTCL. Warning: this episode contains graphic detail of torture, child abuse, child neglect, and adult language. Listener's discretion is advised. If you feel like any of this may be too much for you, have someone listen with you or for you. Good evening, all of my true crime nerds. I want to thank you for sticking with me on this case. Last week's episode was a short one, so tonight's episode will make up for that. Our usual housekeeping tonight, with TTCL closing out for the summer, make sure you're following over on social media to keep up with the show and be on the lookout for when season 5 will premiere. Season 5 will force the librarian to cross the pond to bring you some of those international true crime cases that you've all been wanting to hear. Incorporating international cases into the lineup was something that I have been wanting to do for a while, but somehow it felt off, so I thought there was no better way than to do an entire season of international true crime. So if you have some cases that you're wanting to hear, drop a comment on social media, or stop in at thetruecrimelibrarian.com and drop an email with your suggestions. The lineup is never truly set in stone until I air it, so you never know. Your case could make the show. As always, Patreon is up and running, so if you want even more of the librarian, join in for the bonus show. You can always support the show with a one-time donation over at the webpage, or you can share, review, and recommend the show to other nerds like yourself. Lastly, let's spread some true crime nerd love to all of those who lost their lives in the tragic school shooting of Uvalde, Texas, and their loved ones who never imagined that life would change in the blink of an eye on May 24th of 2002. All right, you guys, enough of this. Let's get to what you all came here for, the true crime. So last week, we followed the Turpins' escape from their financial responsibilities and trouble that they had piled up in Rio Vista, Texas. With David losing his job and Louise spending money on helping her sister escape a marriage after being left behind without anything but the baby growing inside of her stomach. David often let Louise get the family into so much debt that the couple had already filed for bankruptcy twice. It was the trade-off for giving her her dream to have a large family and his desire to have complete and total control over those they called their children. Now in California, the family was starting over on the very little credit they had left, and David had yet to find a job to provide for all of Louise's wants and desires. Over the next several years, Louise was working on severing every connection from anyone, family, or friend, and to her children. This part is incredibly terrifying for the children. Once no one sees you anymore, this means that the abuse is going to ramp up. We saw it in Gabriel Fernandez's case when Pearl Inesario made that last cut, and within a week, Gabriel was gone. It doesn't necessarily mean that time speeds up following that severing. With the Turpin children, it was going to become increasingly worse in the following months and year. With Gabriel, it was like time was traveling on rocket fuel. His abuse was so horrific in those days, his little body just finally gave out. Louise would start by canceling having family come to visit. Each time that her family back on the East Coast had, you know, was like, hey, let's set up a family visit, she came up with an excuse. Sometimes someone was sick. Another was, you know, she was having this really bad feeling about travel, and she couldn't possibly ask her family to come when she has this, you know, unrelenting feeling that something bad is going to happen. Another time she used the excuse that she and David were so mad at something two daughters had done, they were in no mood to host family visits. With each excuse that came, it was just the blade cutting a stitch one at a time. As the visits were slowly being shut down, the less and less that anyone was allowed to talk to the children. It eventually came down to it was only Louise's siblings allowed to talk to the children, and they were only allowed to speak to one child at a time. This way, Louise and David could control the direction of the narrative, or from behind the camera, give death stares as a precursor to even thinking of mentioning how life really looked like at home. Again, we can ask how no one finding this type of behavior odd or different, why didn't anybody speak up? Instead, they all accepted all of these oddities like they were questionable, but normal. Then there is concern raised from the siblings about the social needs of the children. One aunt even questioned whether or not their homeschooling was so strict and severe that it was getting in the way of them going out and having friends and being just like normal teenagers and kids. On October 1st of 2010, David found a loophole in the system to keep officials from questioning why none of the Turpin children were attending school. He opened City Day School and listed himself as the principal. Eight children were in attendance to this school, and they ranged from 1st to 11th grade. There was no religious denomination affiliated within the curriculum. The affidavit of registering the school read, a private full-time school that offers instruction in several branches of study required to be taught in public schools of the state that offers this instruction in English and that keeps attendance records. David and Louise no longer had to worry about anyone coming and asking, you know, why aren't the children in school? Show me proof they're doing, you know, homeschool. David listed his home as a private school. Just another snip in the severing of the children and the rest of the world. There was a loophole with the fact that he was registering this as a private school. Doing so meant that it was required to have yearly inspections by the local fire marshal. There was a failure in this system because in the 7 years that this school was operating, never once did the marshal inspect the house. With each snip of the kids in the outside world, the abuse at home got worse. David and Louise were now tying their children to things with thick rope for breaking some of the most minor infractions. Now that Jennifer and Joshua were considered adult age, David and Louise believed that they had enough control over them that they eased back some, allowing Jennifer to have a phone and Joshua to have a camera. Now, you have to remember that David and Louise spent about 4 years away from most of the children due to their need to fulfill that midlife crisis demands and desires. And now being back in their lives, Louise was going to take complete reign of punishing the children. Each day, the children spent about 20 hours a day in their room. The children often slept during the hours of 3 a.m. to 11 p.m. Remember, they moved their children to nighttime to avoid them maybe possibly playing with others in the neighborhood. And with them being up during the night, it was the complete opposite of everyone else. So, snip, another stitch down. They ate on a very minimal food schedule. They could leave their room to use their restroom eat and brush their teeth. Personal hygiene was still an annual thing among the children. Finally, the children were not allowed to exercise. So this is one that I have seen specifically named when looking into the case of child abuse like this. I haven't ever seen somebody limit a child's exercise. You know what I mean? So you have to wonder, did David and Louise do this so that none of the children could ever become too strong and maybe try to overpower them and escape? To me, that is a lot of planning, right? As a person who has a hard time wrapping my head around thoughts and actions like David and Louise had performed, I really do question, did they really manage to think that far ahead? Well, David was in his 50s and Louise was in her 40s, and it was something that they were eventually going to need to think about sooner rather than later. But did it really stem this early? Jonathan and his indiscretion seemed to be the strongest out of the children. He loved to prank his siblings. He loved to horse around and, you know, be the clown. And unfortunately, it was getting to be too much. So Jonathan was once hogtied because he tried to play a trick on his older brother, Joshua, and hide the camera that mother and father had allowed him to have into the bottom of the trash can. And then the trash was taken out and the camera was gone. So they hogtied him with some thick rope and Joshua chewed his way through the rope and got free. So David and Louise moved to chaining him to his bunk bed. Chains and padlocks would later be discovered by police during their investigation. Jonathan would end up being tied and chained up so much that he suffers from spinal damage, a permanent deformity that he will have to live with for the rest of his life. The girls had their moments and completely different punishments. Like most girls growing up, they went through a phase where they wanted to try makeup and play with their parents. They unfortunately only had their mom's items available to use because none of the girls were allowed to have stuff like this. So they often got into trouble and it would lead to everybody being chained up so that nobody could go in and break things or take things. When Louise got her way and was able to punish them how she saw fit, she performed what she called pitching. Pitching was Louise grabbing the girls by their hair and slinging them around the room as she verbally berated them about them breaking rules and taking things without asking. And it was a sin for kids their age to even have stuff like this. That was one of her favorite ways to treat her daughters. When little Joanna was about 7, she wanted to play with some makeup and went and got into Louise and David's master bedroom to get some things of her mother's. Louise caught her doing so, and the pitching incident started at the top of the stairs. And when she slung Joanna, unfortunately the wrong way, Joanna went down a flight of stairs. And she remembers laying at the bottom of that landing and crying out in pain from the hair pulling and from falling down the staircase. She complained that she was extremely dizzy, that her neck and back hurt. And these symptoms would go on for a few days following this incident. And she was not taking anywhere to be treated for her injuries. That's terrifying to think about. Terrifying that a child can remember that moment in their childhood when you didn't know what all these symptoms were telling you. And it could very well mean you may not survive it. So around this time that all of this is going on and the abuse is ramping up and, you know, Louise is cutting the kids off from family, in her mind, I'm not really sure how this was going to work because, you know, you can't have the level of control that David and Louise had if this would have happened. So in around 2010-ish, we saw that reality TV really started to take off, and families that were large are some of the most successful early reality TV stars. So Louise decides in her feeble little mind that she and her family are perfect for cameras, who at least she thinks they are. In hindsight, we would have more than enough footage to lock Louise and David away for life, not to mention letting the cat out of the bag back in Princeton about her grandfather. I couldn't imagine what following a family like this around would have done for pop culture. Reality TV is a huge moneymaker, but if something like this was to air, it could have made a bigger impact and really brought forth child abuse, and we would see harsher punishments, and we'd see far less children like the Turpin children and Gabriel and the No-Tech sisters, and we would not have to know the life they know, nor would so many have slipped through the fingers of the systems had the Turpins actually made it to reality TV. I think it would have just been a punch in the face. But at the same time, because it was so early, it could have completely went the other way, killed reality television, and everybody would ignore it because you don't want to admit that things like this happen. I mean, I don't know. Louise wanted so much to be like the large families she was seeing on TV. The Goslins or the Duggars. She told family during their phone conversations and the fewer and fewer Skype calls on how she and David were on their way to becoming the perfect family for cameras to follow around. She even claimed that their dream of stardom is what drove David and Louise and their children to move to the land of dreams in California. What we would have caught glimpses of the children who were trained to line up with military precision in the order of their birth, this is something they prided and bragged about in reality. It was just one more, you know, clue as to what was happening in their home. Later in 2010, a post on the social media, the couple's social media showed all 12 children in their homeschool diplomas, something that Louise had simply just ordered off the internet. She was using it to prove progression through the make-believe education system that she and David falsely claimed. David finally found work after nearly a year of living in California. He took a job as a computer engineer in San Diego with a leading aerospace and defense contractor called Northrop Grumman. And this afforded him an annual salary of $143,000 a year, and he had to commute more than 45 minutes from the home on St. Honoré Drive. His shift started at 2 p.m. and lasted till 10. This turned out to be really great for David, as it only furthered the reason the family lived a very nocturnal lifestyle. Around 3 a.m. in the morning, the neighbors began noticing some odd things going on in the backyard of the Turpins. The children could be seen marching around in military fashion. Big reason why the children were capable of lining up with the precision of the military when it came time to load them into the family's minibus. You know, this is something we wouldn't consider normal. But yet again, nothing was said, nor was there ever a check as to why the family lived during the night when the rest of the world slept. Another neighbor recalls seeing the children march through the home as well, back and forth through two of the windows in the upstairs level of the home. And it was back and forth and back and forth all throughout the night. It seemed as though the very few hours that the children were allowed to be awake were filled with activities like this to limit the time they had to actually get into any kind of mischief. Neighborhood children tried for a while following the Turpins moving in to go and knock on the door. Their intention? Inviting the kids out to play and having some more friends to play with. But each knock went unanswered, and after so long, the children just simply gave up. Louise had yet to make that final snip between David and his family when it came to the children. July of 2011, Randy Turpin, his wife, children, made the trip out to California to see David, his younger brother, and their family. Randy's second oldest daughter was about the same age as Jennifer, and the two looked completely different. Randy's daughter looked like a typical 20-year-old would, but Jennifer was smaller and more frail, like in appearance. But since it was rare for the, you know, two families to get together, nothing was thought twice of during the visit. David and Louise treated Randy and his family to their favorite place in the world, Disneyland. It's unknown if Louise footed the bill for everything the two families did, but if you consider her past behavior when it came to family visits, I cannot see it happening any other way. Jennifer would be able to open up to her cousin during this time, telling her her dream of wanting to become a professional singer. She revealed that she'd already wrote the lyrics to 141 songs. Jennifer's cousin was able to even videotape Jennifer singing one of these songs. There's no denying that Jennifer has a naturally beautiful voice. Even during the song she disliked the most, the words flowed beautifully from her lips. Jennifer's cousin was hopeful about Jennifer's future. If only she knew that what Jennifer had been through up to this point and the pain in her voice was something that you can't be taught because you have to live through it. The week following this visit in July of 2011, David and Louise filed for Chapter 7 bankruptcy for a third time. They claimed almost $250,000 in debt during their bankruptcy, and the lawyer had David and Louise take what's called a means test, and this simply is just to determine how much all or some of the debt that would be wiped away. It's also something that Shanann and Chris had to do when they were going through their financial difficulties. This time, they may not have to lose everything like they had in the past. Usually, they lost their home and were only allowed to consider to keep one thing so the courts could hold it as collateral. But everything else was taken, you know, but not this time. $240,564 was owed to nearly 63 creditors. Their assets came to just at $150,000, and $100,000 was claimed in the exemptions. Listed with all of this included repossessed home from Rio Vista, the repossessed double wide trailer, trash services from Rio Vista, unpaid cell phone bills, and bills for pest control services. So David and Louise were instructed, you know, y'all need to take this online course and learn how to manage finances and how to go forward with managing them, because, you know, y'all are shitty at this, you know. So both David and Louise took the course and they passed, and it looked like their debt was going to be wiped away yet again. At the end of October of 2011, David and Louise drove out to Las Vegas and renewed their vows, something that would occur a few more times prior to their arrest. David and Louise had not learned anything from their finance management courses because the two spared no expense with this whole renewing their vows thing. Everything was different when compared to the first wedding, including the bride. She went from a very conservative look to a more sexy, sultry look this time around, which meant that she had to have a new wedding dress. And with a new dress came new hair and new makeup, and Elvis was going to officiate this thing, something that David and Louise would continue to have done by the very same person. David and Louise left the children back in Marietta. Louise and David spent the night out on the town to celebrate afterwards, and they were getting drunk and gambling. Louise admitted to being so drunk that night that she was gambling heavily, and of course, like before, luck wasn't on her side. It hadn't changed from Louisiana to Nevada. David tried to get Louise out of the casino sometime in the early morning hours of their celebration, and she got so angry with David, and it just turned into this huge argument, and all chaos broke loose, to the point that casino security guards had to escort Louise from the casino. Just 6 weeks after this, the Turpins received word that the courts decided to write off almost all of their debt, leaving them with a clean financial slate. Christmas of 2011, David's parents flew out to California to see the family. They recall the children looking normal, healthy. None of them were what they would consider notably skinny or unwell. David's parents stayed with them during this trip. So pangs the question that I keep coming back to, how did you not see something? I've seen clips of the body cam footage from when the officers first made entrance into the Turpin's home, and it was disgusting. Trash and food was everywhere. Officers were having to exit the home for fresh breaths after so long of being in there. However, David's parents never mentioned that living conditions were like this, or that the home was clean and taken care of, or that it had a smell or it didn't have a smell. The reason I ask this so much is because this is the first indication that something at home isn't normal. People who live like this need help in some way. But David's parents described them as being model Christians. Turning these homes from what the body cam footage shows and what is perceived and that family visits look like, two completely different worlds, and it just makes the premeditation into this child torture even worse. They knew enough to cover these early warning signs. September of 2012, Alan Wayne Robinetti, Louise's father, retired from 26 years on the job, and his only goal was to go out to California and see his daughter and his 12 grandchildren. So Wayne booked a flight out to California without telling his daughter because he just wanted to show up and surprise her and the children. And when Wayne landed, he called his daughter to tell her the good news and to ask for the address for the cab. And Louise completely 100% refused to tell her father where she and David lived. And she really didn't give a shit that he was already in California. She was not coming to get him, and she was not going to tell him where she lived. He was not coming to their home at all. He was not going to see them. His best bet, get back on the plane and go back home. Wayne returned home, brokenhearted. He never left the airport. He would not get a chance to see his daughter or his grandchildren again. Wayne passed away 3.5 years following that trip. And Louise never felt an ounce of remorse for what she did to her father. Following the visit from her father, Louise's grandmother passed away in early of 2013. Following this death, Louise opened up a Facebook account aside from the one she and David had as their family account. She uses her maiden name. Louise's sister say that she used this account to browse dating sites. So my question was she excited by what happened in Alabama with her meeting up with that man and the way it drove David jealous and just animalistic? Or was the life she dreamed of not everything she wanted and she was looking for a way out? If I was a betting person, she wanted to drive the passion inside of David. He was getting older, and you know, the older people get and the longer we're married, life slips into ruts sometimes. And with David, it was something he was drawn to, but his younger wife wasn't there yet. And she was not excited to see this dip in her sex life and needed a way to bring it back. So I guess she thought, well, we'll, you know, we identify as swingers. When that happened, maybe we'll do it again and, you know, spice things up. I don't know. It wouldn't surprise me if she was looking to cheat either. So Louise is just not a good person. Louise only looks out for Louise, it seems like. September 2nd of 2013, David and Louise returned to Las Vegas to renew their vows for a second time. The couple booked the same chapel, the same Elvis officiant. It was about a $1,200 ceremony, and this time the children were brought along. The Elvis impersonator is seen singing and dancing with the children. Louise absolutely loved Kent, who played Elvis, and was following his career beyond the Vegas wedding things. And Kent found her knowledge of his career a little odd, but nothing set warning signs off, because he just was like, you know, how are you a mother of this many children and you have time to follow, you know, what I do in my life? This particular vow renewal was very awkward. It was a video recorded and it had the bells and whistles, and like the children, they were all dressed the same. The girls had these handmade dresses and the boys were wearing these tuxes that had details to match the colors in the dresses of the girls. And when Louise walked to the altar, she did so with her daughters in tow. Because of Louise's desire to become the next reality star family, I think they were going to use this whole rouge of vow renewal, record it, and send it off for auditions. I can't fathom how you go from being vile and cruel and evil to your children to having moments like this. How do you go, you know, where's that bridge? It doesn't make any sense to me at all. And I don't know. Around Thanksgiving of 2013, Jordan, the one that would eventually find the strength to save her brothers and sisters, was called to David in the TV room that was in the upstairs part of the home. Jordan was either 13, just turning 13, or she was about to turn 13 when this incident occurred. Jordan walked up to David where he was sitting, and David pulled her pants down. This made Jordan super uncomfortable, so she pulled them back up very quickly. And David reached up, pulled them down again. And before she had a chance to reach down and pull them back up, David picked her up and sat her in his lap. Thankfully, Louise returned home at this moment, and Jordan was able to get down and pull her pants back up. David instructed Jordan that she was to never mention this to her mother. If she did, there would be consequences. Unfortunately for Jordan, this was just the beginning of continual inappropriate behavior with her father. Jordan would identify that David force-kissed her on the mouth frequently. In April of 2014, the level of malnutrition that the children suffered from was really beginning to take its hold on their bodies. Janetta got caught with a Barbie doll, and Louise punished her by putting her in the corner. And after just a couple of hours, she was super sick. She was getting dizzy. She had tingling in her extremities, and she tried to tell her mother that, you know, something's not right. But Louise, she was on the phone. She was jacking her jaw and ignored her daughter's cries that something's not right. So Janetta then asked Joanna to tell her about how she was feeling. Go get mom's attention, because she is terrified of what is going on inside of her body in this moment. And Louise couldn't give two shits. Louise punished Joanna for interrupting her phone call. And the next thing you knew, Janetta passed out and she hit her mouth on the way down and caught her jaw, breaking some teeth and causing a small fracture in her jaw. She was standing in the corner in the bathroom, and so she hit the tile, which made this incident so much worse. Of course, when Louise finally sought medical help, that she ended up telling doctors, Janetta slipped on the wet bathroom floor and hit the ground. Not that she had been standing for so long, and due to the level of malnutrition going on and mealtime only being one time a day, Janetta didn't have the stamina to stand for that long. No, she left all that out. No, what she told them is what Louise wanted them to hear. I became so frustrated recounting this, if you can't tell, because I just want so badly for Louise to know what this feels like. I want her to be put in a corner, and I want her to stand for so long that she can feel the same fear creep through her body slowly as it is shutting down. But that's torture by every definition of the law. And I'd violate that, and I'd violate her rights, even though she did it first. May of 2014, David and Louise purchased a home. Not just any home, a $350,000 home. Thanks to their credit being completely wipe-free, purchasing this house didn't take too much of a fight. And it was a four-bedroom, three-bath home located at 160 Muir Woods Road. The house back on St. Honor Drive was so awful when they moved out of it, it had to be fumigated. With this move, the abuse ramped up even more, especially with Louise. She was now slapping the children around, chaining them to whatever furniture she could find, and they were staying there for even longer periods. This is just some of what was going on. And with David working long hours to keep the family's finances going in the green instead of the red, left Louise the sole punisher more times than not. The kids used to prefer Louise to carry out some of the whippings and things because she couldn't hit as hard as David, but that was no longer true. The abuse, no matter who delivered it, was becoming too much for their frail little bodies to handle. Joshua and Jennifer earned the title of real children because as they got older, mother and father gave them more and more freedom. They were allowed to leave the house at this point with Louise to run errands. Joshua was allowed to watch television with mother and father. And Jennifer had a smartphone and social media, even though she had been in trouble for downloading unapproved apps prior to. This move didn't bring change. The family lived throughout the night and slept during the day. And something that their neighbors caught on to very early in them living there. Each bedroom in the house that belonged to children were lined with bunk beds that became adorned with, you know, chains and padlocks so Louise could lock her suspects up. No one was allowed to leave their bedrooms without permission. Jordan took advantage of being in her room all day without her mother and father's constant eye on her. She walked her room. The short distance it was, she walked it 4 hours a day. She knew her muscles needed to be worked out. She needed to strengthen them. And this was the only way to give her a chance if she needed to fight back. In the new home in Paris, there were things that had never been in the home before. They now had Wi-Fi. They had a landline. By this point, Louise and David felt that they had instilled enough fear into their children that they didn't have to worry about the children trying to escape or even contact anyone to help them on the way out. Before, internet was always hardwired and there was only one phone in the home and Louise took it all the time. As Louise and David limited the amount of hours the children were awake or at least out of their room, they were just only up long enough to eat one time every day. Jennifer was the only person that would prepare the meal. Then Louise would give her permission and she would call down each sibling downstairs one at a time. The children would eat one of three things, either a peanut butter sandwich with chips, a bologna sandwich with chips, or a burrito. They would eat standing at the counter, drink water from the tap, and watched as all these delicious looking baked goods that were purchased for mother and father go bad, grow old, become covered in mold. Nobody would ever eat them. And the children had to eat the same thing, you know, one of three things. It was the same thing all the time. They weren't getting nutrients they needed. There wasn't a mixture of, and to watch something that you know you could eat go bad is, it's torture. Once the child would finish eating, the next child would be allowed to come down and begin eating. Soon after the move to Paris, Louise announced on Facebook with a whole photo of the whole family with the caption that said, in 9 months, we will have a new little one to add. She would name this little girl Jana. Jana would be the last child of David and Louise Turpin. The summer of 2015, Louise's father, Alan, was diagnosed with dementia. His health had gone downhill, quick, fast, and in a hurry. Louise's sister Elizabeth had to move in with their father, and she was given power of attorney, and she was taking care of his estate and selling off all of his stuff. Well, Louise would, you know, get a stick up her ass, decide that Elizabeth was stealing, call Elizabeth up angry and pissed off and accusing her of things because she was stealing from his estate. There was no doubt about it in Louise's mind. Alan's death was the final straw that pushed the paranoid Louise away from her family. When Joshua was 22, Louise surprised the hell out of everybody and enrolled him in a music course at the nearby Mount San Jacinto College. Up until this point, Louise had pretty much given up trying to truly homeschool the children. Despite the fact that David had a registered school that on paper he was the principal for, if Louise isn't teaching them, nobody's teaching them. And if Louise, in the times that Louise tried to teach the kids, it wouldn't be long before she would lose her freaking mind because they either colored outside the lines or they messed up in their writings or the line wasn't straight enough or their circle wasn't round enough. She would lose her crap and begin hitting the kids and throwing them around the house, and none of them had more than, you know, they were getting in trouble for something a kindergartner would struggle with, and they're old enough that coloring inside the lines shouldn't be a struggle. This just goes to show you how neglected these children were. None of their education came from anything true. Jennifer, she was the only person to go inside of a public school system, and she tried really hard to teach them the things that she could remember. But in the end, that's it. That's all the instruction they had. So when Joshua was enrolled in this course, you were like, holy crap. You know, she's going to let him attend school and try to learn something he wanted to learn. Well, it came with stipulations. Joshua was escorted from the front door of the home in Paris to the door of his class in college. And then Louise would stand outside the door and wait for the class to end. And when the class was over, she escorted Joshua back to the car, drove them both home, you know, right back up to the very same front door they had left that morning. He was not allowed to do very much of that whole entire outing without his mother. In early 2015, Louise and David welcomed Jana into the family, and it wasn't long after her birth that David and Louise took her to Disney for her very first photos. Well, Louise was sending copies back home to her and David's family, and their family was excited that they had another child, and you know, it was awesome, and they loved him. They also wanted to see more photos of their other nieces and nephews. Well, Louise always found an excuse. You know, the kids weren't getting along. It was hard to get them all together at the same time. Blah, blah, blah. On March 27th of 2015, John Taylor, Louise's grandfather, celebrated his 91st birthday with his daughter and his last surviving son completely across the country. And on the other side, in the home of his firstborn granddaughter, 17-year-old Jordan Turpin, terrified but desperate, and finally put her plan into motion. It had taken her 2 years to put together a plan to hopefully save her and all of her siblings. She recalls feeling so scared, not only about her own safety, but the safety of her brothers and sisters. She knew that life was not supposed to be this hard at 17. Jordan, a girl who had no idea how talking on the phone even worked, managed to crawl out the window, get far enough away from the house, use a disabled cell phone. We all know they call 911. That's the only thing you can do on a disabled phone. And she dialed 911 and called for help.
911 emergency, what are you reporting?
Hello?
This is 911, do you have an emergency?
I just ran away from home because I live in a family of 15, okay? Can you hear me? And we have abusing parents. Did you hear that?
Okay, how did they abuse you?
Okay, they hit us, they throw us across, they like throw us across the room. They pull our hair, they yank out our hair. I have my two little sisters right now are chained up.
Okay, how old are you?
I'm 17.
What's your name?
Golden Turpin.
What's your address?
Okay, you gotta give me a minute. This is gonna take a while. I've never been out. I don't go out much, so I don't know anything about the streets or anything.
Does anybody at the house take any kind of medication?
I don't know what medication is.
Dispatch was able to track the phone to her location and sent deputies to the home. Jordan waited for the police to arrive. She was standing right in the street, right in the middle of the street, praying that her parents didn't wake up, praying they didn't find that she was missing, and praying they didn't figure out what she was doing, because she knew if they knew the police were on their way, she was going to die. They would kill her before they'd get there. Deputy Anthony Colis arrived on scene and spoke to Jordan. And once Jordan began kind of telling him, he was finding it really hard to believe, you know, because surely to goodness, she was stretching the truth tremendously. But then Jordan shows the deputy photos on the cell phone, and she had taken photos of her brothers and sisters being chained to their beds. She had photos of how malnourished everybody was. They were all so malnourished, it was believed that 13 children were under the age of 18. Between the photos and the basic terminology of how she was trying to describe what was going on, and to add that she had no idea to even how to spell her middle name, the deputy was no longer suspecting this to be a tall tale. He fear grew that this was actually happening, and this wasn't going to be like any other regular last minute call before the end of a shift. This was going to be life changing. Within an hour and a half, deputies were making entrance into the home of David and Louise Turpin. Due to the fact that deputies had reason to believe that the children were in danger, they had legal reason to enter the home without a warrant. Whether David and Louise answered the door or gave them permission, it didn't freaking matter. Children were being harmed, and they could go in that door and do their job. But surprisingly, Louise opened the front door to the knock, and she invited them in. And the expression on her face, it says it all. They were finally caught. David and Louise Turpin were both charged with 12 counts of false imprisonment, 7 counts of abuse of a dependent adult, 6 counts of child abuse. David received an additional charge of a lewd act on a child under the age of 14. Louise had her bail set at $9 million, and David was held under a $12 million bond. David and Louise both entered a plea of not guilty. On February 22nd, 2019, David and Louise changed those not guilty pleas to guilty for the charges of 1 count of torture, 3 counts of willful child cruelty, 4 counts of false imprisonment, and 6 counts of cruelty to a dependent adult. Both David and Louise exchanged these pleas for the sentence of life in prison with the possibility of parole after 25 years. Given the ages of both Louise and David and the extreme nature of their crimes, it's likely that David and Louise will not see the light of day in the free world again in their lifetime. Sadly, in April of 2022, the foster parents of 2 of the Turpin children back in 2018 were sent to prison for similar crimes, adding that at least one of the Turpin girls were listed in the charges of a lewd act on a child under the age of 14. The children have done countless hours of therapy to help them adjust to a world that was once so uncomfortable. I want to thank you all for joining me tonight on this closeout episode of the final series in season 4, Behind Closed Doors. This case blows your mind from the get-go, and we are left wondering why they did these things to their own flesh and blood. How they could stand the stench of 364 days of no bathing, and how they were so cruel they were comfortable living in conditions they had left their home in. This was more than being mean just to be mean. This was being mean to being downright evil. If you want more on this case, then please head over to your local library or Amazon and pick up your copy of The Family Next Door, The Heartbreaking Imprisonment of the 13 Turpin Siblings and Their Extraordinary Rescue by the incredibly talented John Glatt. John is one of my most treasured true crime writers, and I look forward to his aspects on the cases that he covers, so I highly recommend this book. If you know someone or suspect that a child is in danger of abuse and neglect, please contact your local authorities, or you can call the National Abuse Hotline at 1-800-422-4453. Again, that's 1-800-422-4453. Remember, if you see something, you say something. Bring power to these children's voices. As always, I leave you with one last line. Healing. It doesn't have to look magical or pretty. Real healing is hard, exhausting, and draining. Let yourself go through it, and don't try to paint it as anything other than what it is. Much love, the True Crime Librarian.